Going here. This is Deanna Spingola. It is Wednesday, August 1st, 2012, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Veronica Clark. Her websites are veraiconapublishers.org and youtube.com/VeraIcona100. She is the author of several books. She's an amazing, amazing scholar. You will love what she presents. So take it away.
Thank you very much for that great introduction. Okay, I'm going to get through just the important parts in this After the Battle article. If people want the details on this, because there's just too much to go through. As far as all the points I've made in the text, and, you know, we just can't get through it and then hit on all this other stuff too. So we'll just go through the most important parts because I want to get to that Der große Wendig article that talks about other inconsistencies in this story. And then Wilf found another version at the VFZ. So we'll get into what happened to some of these eyewitnesses, etc. And then also, there's a Time article that has some revealing information. And we have the Diary of Halder that has some missing information. Real quick, let's just get the Halder thing out of the way. The Halder War Diary in English does not have the entry for, I believe it's the 20th. Where Canaris tells him he needs those, Canaris was approached by Heydrich that he needed those uniforms, the Polish uniforms.
Oh, right.
That entry is completely missing from Halder's war diary. It is in the German edition, but the English editors didn't feel that that was important. So they left out that entire day. Now, that's a huge problem because Halder may have noted where certain people were on the 20th, which might then conflict with the Gleiwitz story, where they were supposedly in meetings with like Helvig and Trumler and all these other people who were supposed to be leading the false flag. So it's very important that we find out, especially where everyone was on the 20th. I'm going to go through who these people were. And like I said, Wilf and I need help on these things because we just can't get to it all. We're working on it, but, you know, we just can't get to it. And then another day that's extremely important is the 28th of August, 1939. So, again, we need to find out who was with who on those days. Was it possible that Heydrich was in the meetings that he's alleged to have been in by, you know, his supposed co-conspirators.
Right. And you need help in the translation process?
Really, we just need the information. We need to know where, let me find the exact thing I've got here. Okay. Where was Reinhard Heydrich on August 20th?
Okay.
On the 28th, he was at a meeting at the Reichschancellery, according to the Halder diary. Now, Helvig has him, I believe it's Helvig, we'll be getting to that shortly in the After the Battle article. He has him doing something else, giving orders for something on the 28th. I don't think I can just find it off the bat in this article. It's too jumbled. We'll get to it, though. Okay, so we know that that Heydrich was at a meeting at the Reichschancellery. Okay, so can he possibly be giving the orders to Helvig on that day? Would he be when at this Reichschancellery meeting, Hitler is saying that he's not yet sure they're going to be at war? Would Heydrich be continuing the planning, the intensive planning of this false flag at that time on that day? And then where was Himmler and his adjutant Wolf on August 20th? Because allegedly Himmler is over serving Hochlinden on that day. Was he really? And then where was Heinrich Müller on August 20th? That is going to probably be almost impossible to find. Nobody knows very much about Müller except that he disappeared and everyone wanted to hunt him down. but there could possibly be some reference to where he was in a diary or in a memoir. So that would probably be the only place we can look for information on Mueller. Now, I do have the Fedor von Bock war diary, and he drops some interesting bombs that conflict with this after the battle article.
Okay, and that article was in which magazine? Where am I? Is this by
the name of the magazine? Is After the Battle? It is a Britzy publication.
Okay, one is that can by go Whitehead?
To, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's called The Gleiwitz Incident. It's number 142.
Okay.
The name of the publisher is After the Battle. One can go, I think it's afterthebattle.com. I gave the link on our website under Gleiwitz Part 2.
Okay.
Of our last talk. People can just go to that, and there is a U.S. distributor of After the Battle. You cannot get, if you're an American, you cannot get it from the U.K. dealer. You have to go through, I believe it's rmz.com, and get it from that importer. There's another issue that I got that talks about some that incident related to Canaris and the Abwehr. So I'm going to find out what that was all about, because Heydrich suspected sabotage on the part of Canaris. And of course, Wilhelm Keitel. Okay, his memoirs are outstanding. So definitely get those. The memoirs of Wilhelm Keitel, or Keitel, however one wants to say it.
Okay.
He talks about his, you know, his feelings about Canaris and kind of the strange activities that he was involved in throughout. There may be some good information in that too. I haven't had a chance to meticulously read that, just a general going through. So that may be another memoir that we can consult on some of these things.
Okay.
But as far as Fedor von Bock, he says that a regiment had been shot near Ostrzeleka when he and his patrol crossed the border. And this was the 2nd Cavalry Regiment. In the evening, Polish radio reported that an NCO had been shot when he had crossed the border with his patrol. Now, that's pretty interesting, because that could very well be one of these border incidents that was reported by the German press that was then interpreted by the British, or, you know, false flagged by the British as one of these incidents. That happened on August 25th, 1939. And then on the 26th, they got word that that NCO had died. So for some reason, this German NCO with his patrol had crossed into Poland and had been shot. He died, and I don't know if there were other wounded, but there's other incidents like this where Poles crossed into Germany and Germans crossed into Poland. This wasn't unheard of. So we need to be careful in assuming that, oh, that must have been Gleiwitz or Hochlinden or Pitzian that was really being referred to by the German press.
Mm-hmm.
That may be what the Britzies said, but is it in fact what the German press reported? Now, Wilf and I found part two of the White Book on the internet. There's a version on Scribd that's in that horrible gothic font. It's really hard to read.
Uh-huh.
But there's also a better version. It was on archive.org. So if one just looks up, I can send you the link.
Okay.
And, you know, one can just put it through Google Translate and get a decent enough rendition of it. But all the incidents that had occurred way before Gleiwitz are listed in there. And there were many, many things. There was persecution of German speakers, German university students, school children. There was a threatened blockade of Danzig. There was all kinds of stuff going on. So once again, Gleiwitz, not any cause for war. That's nonsense. Now, another important detail that Bock gives in his diary is that he drove to the frontier guard in Poisenfeld and to the customs post at the border, all quiet. Now, that can't be, because on the 26th is allegedly when things were starting, when the false flag got an accidental early start, jumped the gun, if you will, before Hitler was really committed to actual combat with Poland. So how come Bach is saying all is quiet when in fact that was when the false flags were starting? That's kind of a problem. And what was the Frontier Guard doing on the border still when they were supposed to be being dismissed by these SD and SS men who were into this covert operation? And again, can the SS and the SD really tell the Wehrmacht to get out of the way? I mean, we literally have in this After the Battle article, supposedly some Wehrmacht general, we're not given the name, is told to stand down and retreat from the border by an SS man.
I mean, on whose
authority, buddy? You know, this is unrealistic. Another thing, also nothing out of the ordinary, in Oberst Buch's Frontier Guard sector, that would be the 2nd Frontier Guard Detachment, September 1st to the 24th, October 1939 in Krajinka. So again, nothing unusual going on, no Wehrmacht being ordered around by the SS, those kind of things. He also mentions that the diplomats between Germany and Poland are negotiating, but with warm cannon. What he means is, I think war is on the horizon. This is merely just stalling for time. So again, we don't need the Gleiwitz excuse. It's totally nonsensical.
Right.
The English fleet was already in blockade positions in the North Sea on the 26th of August. Remember, the war wasn't actually declared until 4:45 a.m. on September 1st. So, you know, it's idiocy to think that Hitler needed an excuse when everyone was already partially mobilized.
Right.
And things were going on.
And had been for, you know, since the end of World War One.
Exactly. Exactly. And then he also refers to the alleged quote-unquote spy. I guess apparently, four sanatorium patients fell upon a man messing about in the garden, took him into custody and locked him up. Cause you know, everyone is on pins and needles right now. Well, this alleged spy turned out to be a plainclothesman from his headquarters, from Bach's headquarters. So are we really thinking that people in civilian clothes can just run around arresting people, not identifying themselves properly, such as when Haniak is approached and arrested by alleged Gestapo in civilian clothing? You know, that's not what Haniak's family said. They refused to speak to anyone. So we don't even know who arrested Haniak, which was the German Pole who was left dead at the scene at the Gleiwitz radio station, but whose body was never found after the incident happened.
Really?
So, yes, his body was never found. So this is another one of those strange mysteries. And then the concentration camp inmates who were allegedly drugged and left at Hochlinden, which there's all kinds of different versions of how many people were left. Well, they were allegedly relocated to a mass grave, which was then reported by some mayor or something in Poland, and he had it basically dug up. You know, you got to get this out of here. And there was just rubbish in the hole.
So no
were there any bodies ever?
Yeah.
There was nothing there. No human remains whatsoever. So it's very strange. And of course, the Germans allegedly, the Gestapo particularly, had the bodies of all the victims that were allegedly left at the scene, which were all supposed to be Poles, which to me doesn't make sense. Wouldn't you rather have Germans left dead at the scene?
Yeah.
Who then the Gestapo takes those German bodies back into Germany and identifies them and gives a fake report? You know, that doesn't, why would you have Polish citizens left dead at the scene? That would be the right of the Poles to take those bodies and identify them.
Absolutely.
In my view, you would want to leave your own people at the scene.
Sure.
So that you can cover up your trail. But no, the Germans were idiots, you know.
I don't think so.
Absolute idiots leaving Poles at the scene. Yeah, right. So anyway, they were allegedly photographed. And then that would then be used for propaganda. But not only did the photographs never show up of any of these alleged concentration camp victims, the canned goods, if you will, that Mueller dropped off, but it was never used for propagandistic purposes. So why did you take the photos if you weren't going to use it for propaganda?
Indeed.
The question is, were those photos ever taken at all? That's really what we're running into, is a false flag that didn't even happen. Very strange. The whole thing is so bizarre. It's just, it's really right out there.
Right. When you put all those pieces together, they just don't add up.
And exactly.
And certainly it wasn't necessary. But as you mentioned before, this was brought out at the IMT, and so this is what they claimed in order to have justification for what they did to Germany.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's nonsensical.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what's really important, and one can look up the Hossbach Protocol hoax. That's another hoax. On Mark Weber, way back in the day, wrote a very good article on the Hossbach Protocol. Just look that up on the Journal of Historical Revision. Is that it?
Right, I think so. Institute of Historical Revision.
Journal of Historical Review.
Right.
Yeah. Look it up on that. Just read that article, because before the Allies had that fraud, they used Gleiwitz. So this is why they needed it. They needed to pin guilt on Germany, and they did it with Gleiwitz. But then, boom, ching, this wonderful Hossbach fraud came up. So then they switched to that. So it's really important that people realize that. So in the Grosse Wende article mentions that. So I'll try to get to that too. Interesting note from Bach again. He asked what the reaction had been when the order came to withdraw from the frontier of the 20th Victorin and 2nd Bader divisions. And the soldiers didn't like it at all. Lessened their morale. It was difficult to get them to even back off a little bit from that border and stand down. So do we really think the SS is going to be able to get cooperation from the Wehrmacht? And, you know, for what? I very seriously doubt the Wehrmacht is going to tolerate such a thing, going, wait a minute, what are you going to do? What? Why are you ordering us to stand down so that you can have some covert action? I don't think so. And they were rivals, we must remember. And of course, so were the SD and the Abwehr. They were enemies. They are described by historians who know as arch enemies. And yet we have Heydrich and Mueller and Canaris, all good friends, speaking together on a false flag. No,
I don't think so.
Here's another thing we tend to overlook. On the 29th, Bach asks Halder, how is the Lithuanian mobilization being interpreted? His answer was, it's not against us in any case. So we have Lithuania, which was also mobilizing against a potential Polish or, you know, perhaps a German threat, but you know, we're totally missing the whole picture of the Eastern Front here. It wasn't just Germany gearing up for war. And again, Poland participated with Germany in the dismemberment of Czechoslovakia. So, you know, everybody was already involved in this kind of war process that it's very difficult to get the wheels stopped once they're started, especially when you have Britain and her allies pushing for war. They wanted it. That's not easy to stop that process.
Exactly, yes.
Okay, so we have Lithuania mobilizing at the same time Germany and Poland are, but yet we never hear about that.
Well, they didn't want to blame anything on them. They wanted to put everything onto the Germans' backs.
Exactly, yep. And even Bach says one has the feeling that the situation is coming to a head. that war is unavoidable, and he says England is apparently not giving in. On the 30th, he mentions that the Poles are going to Berlin today for negotiations. Okay, so if the Poles are going for negotiations on the 30th, we're really going to have a false flag implicating the Poles before we're ready to even engage in war with them, potentially destroying the whole process of negotiation. No! it's idiocy. And then he mentions militarily nothing significant. So again, he's not stating that anything out of the ordinary. There's been no withdrawals. There's been no dismissed frontier police, etc. Nothing strange going on here. And then, of course, Bach does not get the advance warning for the attack until the evening of the 30th. This is Bach, General Fedor von Bach. He doesn't even know until that evening that they're definitely going to war. So, you know, how come the SS and the SD are in on this more than the Wehrmacht generals themselves?
Right.
They get more priority and know more? No. And of course, we have Hoffman, who described on the Western Front as a Gestapo authority, that he didn't know anything until it broke in the news in the West. So this isn't something the high command is going to assign to Heydrich. He's not going to know when the war's going to be starting.
Right. Mm-mm.
I don't buy it. Okay, I think that's pretty much all we need to go over. He does mention that the 3rd Panzer Division had already taken casualties on the 1st of September. So, you know, this isn't like Germany just blasting her way in. They were getting shot up too. And of course, we already had the incident of the NCO who was shot.
Well, they actually were, the Poles were militarily superior.
Right.
And they were ready. I mean, they had all the, they had sorties into Germany all during the end of August, I believe.
Right. Yep. And Bach mentions the 50th Division is not as good as he thought and others thought. It had 10% untrained and many very old replacements. The Germans were really scrambling around and sometimes scraping together from almost nothing certain divisions. So absolutely correct. They weren't all bold and going in there like blitzkrieg, like everyone says.
Right. Right.
And the planned capture of the Westerplatte by the German Navy failed. So there you go. They didn't always have victory. Right at the beginning there. So that's right. From Fedor von Bach, his war diary. He's got other good information in there, but that should suffice for now. This Time article, let me just jump to that real quick. This article is from August 28th, 1989, and what it says is that German SS troops, not SD, took 12 prisoners from the Oranienburg concentration camp, which is Sachsenhausen, ordered them to dress in Polish army uniforms, which is not true. They dressed in those uniforms well after the fact, were not ordered to do so, but volunteered to do so. Then they were supposedly injected with poison and shot. The 12 quote-unquote Polish casualties were dumped in a forest near the village of Hochlinden to be exhibited later to the foreign press. No, that never happened. So what this article is doing is it's just telling you 100% pure hearsay lies. And when you actually go to fact check it, you go, no, it wasn't 12. No one knows how many it was. In fact, most people say there were none at all because there were no bodies ever found and no photographs ever turned up. People that really look into this. And no, it wasn't exhibited to any foreign press. That never happened. And then they say that they took along one more Oranienburg prisoner and he was left at the Gleiwitz radio station. No, that's not true. It was supposedly Franz Haniak who was left there. And of course, his body was never found, and his family never talked about who arrested him, why, or what exactly had happened. In fact, they wouldn't even say that he was arrested, so we don't even know that he was. He may well have been kidnapped from somebody, or by somebody. We just don't know, and this is, again, you know, when we need to find out the details of these things. What actually happened to this man, and what didn't? They also describe it as the intruders shouting in Polish over the open microphones and saying that their comrades were invading Germany. They ran off, leaving the corpse of the prisoner, Haniak, as one more Polish casualty. Okay, there weren't many microphones. There was one, and it only to the local people, because it was the weather transmitter, basically, for just that Gliwice area. Remember, it was just a relay station for the Breslau station, so it was like a transmission station, if
right,
you will.
Right, it was just a little facility that was not that important. I mean, if they were going to do a real false flag event, I would assume that they would do it at some more major place.
Exactly. They would have done it at Breslau, more than likely. So, yeah, exactly. And they weren't shouting in Polish and blah, blah, blah. It was only one person announcing the alleged Polish takeover over this microphone, which can't be confirmed by anyone.
Well, I think the Time magazine story is just to try to give that story credibility. And if you look at the history of Time magazine and the people who started it, they were mostly Yale alumni like Henry P. Davison and associated with J.P. Morgan and that kind of thing. So, mm-hmm. you know, that was their function, just to give that story credibility.
Exactly. Exactly. It does mention a couple, you know, tidbits, though, that are valuable. For example, Poland was initially pro-German, and this was as late as 1938 until the Britzies got in there and corrupted all that.
Right.
And it, you know, when it joined with Hitler in the dismemberment of Czechoslovakia. So again, last time we already went over what Will found as far as the corruption of the 1934 German-Polish non-aggression pact. It was the Britzies, the Americans getting in there, causing all kinds of trouble, fomenting for this war between the two countries. And of course, that was also to basically give Stalin a free hand and come in the other side. I'm not buying that the Allies didn't foresee that.
Oh,
that
they
democracies
planned it.
Didn't. Come on. I mean, they knew that Stalin had aggressive intents. So that's just nonsense.
Of course, they knew that since 1925.
Right. And I mean, he went in on the 17th, and of course, he had a difficult time excusing his attack. So what he said is, it was for the reason, quote, to restore peace, end quote.
Right.
So Stalin has to restore peace and order in Poland, and that's why he invaded. Yeah, just tell him peace.
Sure.
Make war, but say peace.
Yes.
You know, wage war, but call it Department of Defense.
Right, or call it imposing democracy or whatever
yeah.
it is.
We're bringing democracy and liberating you from the government you elected.
Right.
Incredible. That's what we did to the, Libyans.
Yeah.
Okay. So, real quick, there's one more good little thing in this article. Right here. Let me just read it. But the Poles refused to abandon an inch of their land, and the Germans' surprise attack across the unfortified frontier threw the defenders into confusion. Military units got separated and cut off. Refugees jammed the highways. Communication systems broke down. The Germans not only knew Polish codes, but also broadcast false information on Polish radio frequencies. This would explain why there was, in fact, a German-Polish language exercise by two SS men who properly identified themselves at Gliwice before the outbreak of the war. You know, just because two things seem to be connected, correlation, does not mean they are. It's
right.
Simply correlation, not causation. So, just because the two SS men really did go to that Gliwice transmitter and do a exercise in Polish and German, It very well could have been attached to something like this, where they were practicing for giving false information to Polish military units to throw them into confusion during the war, not for the false flag. So, you know, that's just, we must be careful not to not make something that isn't really connected, connected.
Right.
Okay, real quick, let's just go over what Will found as far as the fates of some of these other people. Now, this Kloza guy is really important to this story because he is allegedly an eyewitness of the attack on the Gliwice station. I don't know if I can find him off the bat. He, I don't know if he was told to put his hands up. Okay. Kloza was, you know, the evidence of the attack that everyone cites. He lived there with his wife at the station. And, okay, so, hardly anyone heard the message, but the noise caught the attention of the wife of station manager Kloza, who was listening to the radio. The Klozas lived on the station premises in one of the two housing blocks alongside the forecourt. Now, she had alerted her husband that something was wrong, so he walked across to the station to have a look. As he came in, a man inside pointed a pistol at him, so he immediately withdrew, slammed the door, ran away, and alerted the police. And also went to inform the chief of the telephone exchange. Now, let's see what happens to... I think he has it in here. Maybe not. He has Kotz. Okay, it must be in the other... It must be in the other document. Okay, hold on. Let me just go through some of these other ones real quick. Okay, so the police station, the following persons were interviewed, allegedly for the evidence of this. The police station, Gliwice, the leader of the response team died. So at this Gliwice police station, and other members couldn't be found. Now that, I don't think that's Kloza. I thought Wilf mentioned him, and I'm not seeing it now. Oh, there it is. Okay, it is in here. He was killed by partisans in 1945.
Oh, how convenient.
Exactly. Okay, so Kloza, who is the key eyewitness, was killed in 1945, allegedly by partisans. Okay, so I'm glad I found that. I knew it was in there. Okay, so the police station leader at Gliwice, he died. Other members couldn't be found. The wife of the chief of police, Dr. Paltin, was on leave at the time. His deputy, the deceased W. Shada, had taken over. So Shada died. Dr. Paltin wasn't there at the time. And then Shada died. So we can't get any information from him, or couldn't. Police officers and officials of the secret police were allegedly interviewed. Who? Well, those are all the ones in the after the battle story that are either IMT or, you know, what have you. Another very important person, I didn't have a chance to go through his testimony before our show. It's just 67 pages. But it's Lahousen, L-A-H-O-U-S-E-N. One can just go to that Avalon project that Yale does about the IMT.
Right.
Look up Lahousen. He says it's Operation Himmler, not Operation Tannenberg. His details conflict with everyone else's. He's the source of the Canaris uniform thing with Heydrich.
Uh-huh.
So this is one of those special people that, you know, bought freedom.
Right.
Okay, so the security police, again, allegedly they were interviewed, but which security police? Now, this is the VFZ article. So, you know, this is another German archival institute, if you will, that has a whole different story than Naujoks and after the battle about the Gliwice affair. Everybody has a different version. The commander of the security section at Gliwice, officers of police station 4, the station in the district, the chief, Bim, died. So we have another one who died, you know, couldn't corroborate anything with him. The radio operators, again, Kloza was killed by partisans. What happened to the other ones? Well, Kotz died of anemia in 1945. The antenna maintenance person Foitzig died of thrombosis in 1940. The fate of the official Naroth, N-A-W-O-R-O-T-H, is unknown. And this is according to the report by Naujox. So, you know, anybody that might have witnessed something and could have told these details, they're all dead. Every one of them.
or they sold out.
Or they sold out, right. But the actual radio operator people were all dead. So everyone who was in that station at the time this allegedly took place, dead. 1940, 1945, you know, what happened there?
Right.
And of course, the other one disappeared, so we don't know what happened to him. The first chief of Radio Gleiwitz, and now Wilf says Mr. N was chief of the station till June 1939. He was then transferred to Oppeln as chief postal inspector. And again, this is Naroth. His wife still lived at the station at the time of the raid and telephoned her husband the same evening, as did the new station chief. Naroth then gathered additional information during his visit the weekend following. But again, what happened to him? We don't know. So it's just nonsense. Absolute nonsense.
Indeed.
Right. Okay, so let me go through these other anomalies that are put out by this Große Wende book. Now, this comes out in many, many volumes. And the guy who basically, I guess, inspired it, if you will, is Dr. Heinrich Wende. And so this is like, I mean, there's literally probably thousands of essays of revisionist material in German in these volumes. And this is one of them on the whole Gleiwitz thing. Here are, this is basically a list of problems with Naujox. So the first thing, Naujox in his 1945 declaration never mentions his SS rank, not even that he was part of Section 4 of the SD. So just because they've written that in there, in this after the battle article, et cetera, doesn't mean he was. The Allies merely just made that up to make it sound good so that Naujox was credible.
Oh, right.
That Heydrich personally, by ignoring the whole of the procedural process, communicated with Naujox and only orally or by phone, leaving no documents.
Ah.
Yeah. That Naujox was picked by Heydrich for personal reasons, but those were never revealed by Naujox even later. And we've gone over why that's so unlikely after he bungled the Prague radio transmitter incident, Otto Strasser's black transmitter. And there were issues after. He also was a participant in the Venlo incident, where the British basically said, let Freemasonry, you know, be good to Freemasons again and get back on the gold standard and we'll be your best friends kind of a thing, Germany. We won't touch you in Poland. He was part of that. So maybe his priviness to that British treachery may have been one other motivating factor in kind of negotiating with this Naujox.
Right, right. I wonder if he was...
Zawicki.
Yeah.
Head.
Huh.
And did you want to add something?
Fascinating. This issue of Freemasonry, I wonder if Naujox was a Freemason.
It's possible. Although he couldn't have ever been.
Oh, right, because he was in Germany. Okay.
Yeah, if he became one maybe later, or, you know, just nominally rejected it, but there's no way he was in the SS at any point as a Mason.
Okay.
Heydrich looked into people's background pretty closely, and so did the SS generally. So he could have been one prior to or after, though. That's
right.
Certainly possible. But yeah, he was involved in the Venlo incident along with Schellenberg. And of course, Schellenberg also survived. He was part of kind of the Operation Paperclip thing. So again, is it because Schellenberg was privy to that Allied treachery? It's possible that that was part of why these people were treated leniently. Of course, Schellenberg also had a lot of intelligence on the USSR, etc., and some of America's future, quote-unquote, enemies, so they could use him. That none of Naujox's superiors or anyone from the local SD office knew anything of the Gleiwitz event. No one knew anything, never said anything, never came forward, nothing.
Huh. So he was the only one that really was...
Only one. And they were able to get a couple other people, Herbert Mailhorn, for example, this Lahausen, I can't remember his first name, to say a few more little details that they connected to Gleiwitz. And of course, Mailhorn gave an interview to Stern magazine in the 60s. So one can probably, I think one can still find that on the internet. I'm pretty sure I found it a long time ago. So it's in German, but it's right there. And his story conflicts with Naujoks's. Whoops. On anything. Which means that, you know, the lies have many versions, the truth only has one.
Right.
It'd be that hard to recount what really happened if it did. You know, that's just the kind of silliness we're running into. That Naujoks never provided any details regarding the location. Okay, so, you know, we're never told any details. The details that are featured in this after the battle come from books that were published long after the war, and the kind of filled in details, if you will, from these other people's IMT testimony, etc., by court historians to make it sound real credible.
Sure.
Yeah. That Naujoks never mentioned any of the names of his alleged compatriots or accomplices. Okay. The names of these other people, Helvig, Mailhorn, etc., come from other sources. Not from Naujoks. He never mentioned one name. That Naujoks later admitted that the members of his unit were not SD men of Section 2 and 4, but originated from various sections in the Heydrich Agency. How convenient, so that we can never track any of them down. We have no names. We don't even know where they're from, what their ranks were, nothing. That's just... It's
not typically German, and there would be records, and he would have said who they were. This is all put together so that you can't check out any of the facts.
Exactly.
Basically.
You can't verify anything. Nothing. That the German propaganda of that time never made use of this Radio Gleiwitz incident. Neither Hitler nor Goebbels mentioned anything. Not even the Völkischer Beobachter refers to it. So, if any paper would have really gone all out like they did with the assassin Ernst von Rath, the Herschel Grinspan, you know, the Völkischer Beobachter made a huge deal out of that. Jewish
right.
conspiracy, et cetera, et cetera. They would have done the same thing with Gleiwitz.
Of course.
So, all this effort went into this false flag, and they never even mentioned it. That doesn't make sense.
No, it certainly doesn't.
It was a blaring headline all over the world. And they already knew terrorists did it. They had already been talking about terrorism that morning on faux news, etc., before it happened.
Right.
It's just incredible.
Right. And, so, and the British papers did the same thing.
Exactly. Exactly. So they prepared us. And people still bought it. Just incredible.
Well, it's because they keep hearing it, especially in the alternative media.
I know. That in the German white paper number one, regarding events prior to the war, the Gleiwitz case is only mentioned in a footnote. And in white paper two, which is the one that's online, it's only referred to in four lines as one of 44 border incidents initiated by Poles. So white paper number one, which, you know, I can't find anywhere. I never did get my white book.
You didn't?
I never got it. I had to file a claim.
You're kidding.
No, and I've never had to ever file a claim. So I never got the book I ordered. I was hoping that had like number one, two combined. And I think it does. But I never got it. So, you know, it's a conspiracy again.
Well, did they say that they shipped it?
They supposedly did, but it got lost in transit, I guess.
My goodness.
I wanted to see that, though. I really wanted to see the footnote and then the four lines about Gleiwitz. Now, I tried searching Gleiwitzer, Gleiwitz and Gleiwitzer, and also Arthur Naba. in the white book number 2 on the internet, and nothing came up. So which 4 lines, I'm not sure what Vendik is referring to, because the search doesn't yield it. Now, it could just be that the search feature is garbage and it's not working. Mm-hmm. So may just have to read that and go through it. But again, if Gleiwitz is going to be your real casus belli, you want to mention it more than just a footnote and 4 lines in your second white paper.
Of course. You got to make a big deal out of it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That the Polish press at that time did not mention this incident to correct the German version. Now, that's really important. If the Poles were being accused of this, they certainly would have reported something about it or said, excuse me, wait a minute here. We want an investigation into this. Did in fact some civilians, insurgents, or Polish soldiers do this? More than likely, that would have been seen as a breach on their side by their own people.
Right.
I don't necessarily know that the Polish army, etc., would have condoned such activities by their people. So why didn't they mention even a thing that they didn't, and they didn't call for an investigation? That the low-ranking Nowyaks, according to himself, that is, quote-unquote, instructed Gestapo police chief Miller to hand over this man, the criminal, that is. Okay, no, he's not telling Gestapo Miller what to do. So you told him to hand over this man to him near the radio station. So, yeah, hand me that body and I'll lay him here, Mr. Mueller. No. And there's one part where Mueller drives to Hochlinden, drops off the bodies, he flies there, I think. Gives an order and flies away. I mean, are you really going to fly in a plane to give an order and then fly away? And then in another instance, he drives up in a black saloon car. It's always a black saloon car. And apparently someone was watching these very minute kind of detective-esque details. It was pitch dark outside. No one could see. But we did see the black saloon cars pull the pitch dark. That's this after the battle article. Where Mueller drives up, drops off the canned goods, that is the concentration camp inmates who have been murdered, and then drives off. Why would he need to be the one to do that?
Of course. It
flies to Hochlinden, gives an oral order, and then flies off? No one noticed. In an aircraft on the eve of war? And no one noticed.
Ridiculous.
It's idiotic. There's all kinds of flying going on, actually. And, of course, Himmler comes and reconnoiters the area. No, I'm going to do some reconnaissance myself here in Hochlinden. And that's allegedly on the 20th. And he goes with Wolf. And I suspect that Wolf is the source of that lie. So I'd like to find out where Himmler and Wolf really were on the 20th. It may be in just any kind of Himmler biography, we got to start looking for these things. Just snap up some biographies of Heydrich and Himmler, read them and see if there's anything. It's going to be one of those small little details that an historian didn't even think was very important that really is going to be the one piece of evidence that collapses this so badly. You know,
right.
In opinion, it's already collapsed. There was no Gleiwitz incident. It didn't happen. Anyone that says Gleiwitz happened is, they're really inventing it or lying. They're flat out lying, or they're totally misinformed and haven't looked at the details. But any kind of little detail like that about Heydrich or Himmler that may be floating around in some archive somewhere, some diary, some, you know, biography, it would really do it, I think, for the general public. Because if you say, no, he was here, that's one impossible thing that as soon as there's one absolutely impossible corroborated thing in a book, mm-hmm. which is what people need to see, it's over. It's over.
Okay, listeners. So that's what our homework is.
That's what we need. And I picked up the oldest biography on Heydrich I could find, hoping that because it's kind of pre-Gleiwitz, before this legend took off, hopefully it will say the truth. And it won't have references to that, but we'll see. That's really what we need, is preferably German language material prior to 1961. I'm pretty sure that's when this movie was put out. Let me double check that. And this is in the after the battle article too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Movie in 1961, the East German State Film Production Company, DEFA, produced a feature film on the Gleiwitz affair. This then prompted the German government to investigate, couldn't find any perpetrators whatsoever. No one. And right before Naujoks was to be brought to trial for murdering Haniok, he died. So that's one of those really convenient deaths. So convenient, it's suspicious. So prior to 61, if possible, some kind of 1950s or late 1940s biographies, preferably in German, before this took off, finding out where those people were would be preferable. It's going to be very difficult to find, I'm sure, though.
Right.
So, okay, going on with a few more of these details, that before and after 1945, the employees of Radio Gleiwitz described this quote-unquote raid differently than Naujoks did, that the Gleiwitz police president in charge, Schade, was never cross-examined at the Nuremberg trial, that even though he had been interrogated repeatedly by the Russians as well as the Americans, he was soon after found murdered in a Polish concentration camp.
Hmm.
Right. That Naujoks' additional statement to the explanation by Mueller, and this is, Wilf was kind of confused by the translation, but what he's referring to is Mueller's supposed action of leaving the 12 or 13 convicted criminals dressed in Polish uniforms at the scene to show that they had been killed during the action. That action and Mueller's statement cannot be verified, but it is still marketed in their literature as evidence of German guilt. Who is going to know what Mueller said other than what Naujoks said he said? That the only account of Mueller's involvement is Naujoks. So that's a huge problem.
That is. Mm-hmm.
And without any proof. It's pure hearsay without anything to back it. No factual evidence whatsoever. They never found any of these bodies. Not one. You generally do not have a murder without a victim.
Right.
So not without at least one credible witness who has not completely collapsed his own testimony. It's very difficult to make the case for murder without the presence of at least a body.
Right.
So, you know, this is a huge problem. And of course, what was the rubbish pile in that hole that they were directed to? And did that even happen? I mean, there's so much crazy stuff. I don't even know. Not one of the accused at Nuremberg had any knowledge of this raid. That Naujoks, in a later Spiegel German magazine interview on November 13, 1963, page 71, indicated that the text of the broadcast announcement had been composed by his men and that he had received no instructions at all as to the content.
Hmm.
Now, Wendig says highly unlikely given the circumstances of the plan. They just let Naujoks' guys make up the speech right then and there impromptu. On his own authority.
Not credible.
That witnesses of the event never heard the shots allegedly fired by Naujoks. Here's another interesting detail from after the battle. After Naujoks leaves, the incident at Gleiwitz was allegedly still going on and shots were fired.
Really? So how could Naujoks testify to something that he didn't see because he had left?
Exactly. This is a huge, strange question for me. I'm thinking, okay, wait, what? How is it going on after he leaves?
Mm-hmm. That doesn't
make any sense at all. I don't know if I can find that right off the bat. Again, this isn't after the battle. Anyone can get this. It's like $8 for this. Another strange thing was that the Sicherheitspolizei guards were put there by Heydrich et al. And one of them was beaten and shot or taken prisoner. It's like, now, wait a minute. Why would you take one of your own SP guys?
Right.
Sicherheitspolizei that you put there beat him and put him in cuffs and take him down with the other prisoners. That doesn't make any sense.
No.
I mean, you know, what had he done? Yeah, here's the part. So Naujox telephones Heydrich to report on the successful achievement, but to his surprise, you know, Heydrich is fuming. I didn't hear a thing. You didn't really do the broadcast, did you, Naujox, you liar? Heydrich is supposedly going, this is going to have a wide impact. Everybody, they'll hear it in Britain. They'll hear it in Poland. It'll be our casus belli. No, no one heard it, including Heydrich. It's because it didn't happen. Didn't happen. And of course, Heydrich never said any of this. This is all invented by Naujox. He said Heydrich said this. Pure, the whole thing is a lie. You're literally reading just a series of lies in this After the Battle article and a bunch of other silliness. And it's obvious. Anyone that reads this is going to shake their head. Just, you know, they'll say like a Wehrmacht general ordered this, a motorcycle dispatcher, the inspector, never any names, never any details. Okay, so he says, meanwhile, after Naujox left and Heydrich is fuming at him, back at the radio station, events were still in progress. As they were standing with their face to the cellar wall, who testified to this anyway? The four captives in the basement heard a single pistol shot ringing out from the generator room. Shortly after, they noted that their guard had gone. Oh, hey, our guard is gone. We can leave now. Machinist Kautz, his hands still bound, ran over to manager Klose's house to say that the intruders had left. Now, remember, Klose murdered by partisans in 45. He and Klose ran back to the transmitter building and, as they entered, found an SD, Sicherheitsdienst officer, almost certainly one of the canned goods men, says the author. Almost certainly, that's an oxymoron.
Right.
Did by pointing... at them. I'll shoot you. You know, the SD guy. I'll shoot you. He knows these. He knows Klose. He knows these people. He was just like taken prisoner with them. Why would he aim his pistol at him?
Exactly.
Sense. Klose and Kautz identified themselves. Whoa, whoa, easy, Tiger. And were then allowed to free the other three captives in the cellar. Total idiocy. Like the SD man, who was replaced by the SP man, the Sicherheitspolizei man, wouldn't know who Klose was and point his gun at him. That doesn't make sense to me. But who shot? Okay, Naujox had already left. He went back to this hotel, Haus Oberschlesien, where he was staying for over 2 weeks, completely cordoned off from the entire world, blacked out windows, etc., and yet no one ever said a thing. Okay, he's already back at the hotel. You hear a gunshot. Who shot and who was shot?
Oh, gosh.
Strange story. It's really fun, actually. Here's another one. Okay, well, we know that the witnesses never heard shots allegedly fired by Naujox. Well, you know, who testified to the shot fired after he left? Who knows? And then that other murder commandos attested to by Naujox could never be proven to exist. So he had mentioned other murder commandos. None of them could ever even be confirmed as in existence. These people. That Naujox was never persecuted by the Allies for this raid. He was released in 1945, died allegedly in 1966, right before he was going to be brought to trial. But he has a couple different deaths. And that he was even later not held accountable for his actions when he reappeared in the Federal Republic of Germany. Now, this guy flew to South America. He never mentioned to his comrades when he was in U.S. custody in a camp in Langwasser, never mentioned anything to his comrades there, who were also interned, that he had been involved in the Gleiwitz raid. And Mr. Naujox at some time had a longish discussion with IMT priest Sixtus. Following this, he told his comrades that he would get out of the camp and fly to South America. The next morning, he was gone.
Ah.
And he left the affidavit for the IMT.
How handy.
Unknown by the Allies. So they protected him. Go fly away, Mr. Nyox. Make yourself a new life. Thank you. That's basically exactly what happened. Now, there was a guard at Gleiwitz, and they were all armed. This will be the last detail I go over, because this is really important. Nyox and others claim that the guards were removed from the area. Everyone was taken out so that this false flag could go on uninterrupted. We have, since 1991, the depiction of the event by an eyewitness, the public school teacher Otto Radek. When the Border Guard, a paramilitary organization in Upper Silesia consisting of volunteers, was established in 1939, Otto Radek, as captain in the reserve, was put in command of the guard in the territory around Gleiwitz. Radio Gleiwitz, located just 7 kilometers from the German-Polish border, was guarded by Border Battalion 1/68, the guards armed and live rounds issued. He heard about this raid from Radio Breslau, so he didn't hear it from the Gleiwitz transmitter, but from Breslau, which could have been a British broadcast, because the British apparently had a little outfit there at Breslau, kind of a covert thing. Drove immediately to Gleiwitz and saw a peaceful scene. Nothing was known about a shooting. No signs of bullet holes were anywhere. The guards reported that they had allowed a few SS men in civilian clothing to enter the broadcast room only after the men had identified themselves properly, and that those men then conducted speech practice in German and Polish via a weather channel. That was because they didn't want it to go out to everybody. It was just an exercise. And the Time magazine article explained why such an exercise would have been necessary at that time. They were getting ready to start confusing the Polish army about their own orders by issuing counter orders in Polish over their communication lines. So this makes perfect sense if it's looked at from that perspective.
Right.
And after a few minutes, they departed correctly. They left with a Heil Hitler. A phone call by the commander to army headquarters in Breslau revealed that all was in order. So nothing happened. Neighbors confirmed that nothing happened. All was quiet. There was a Hitler Youth member who lived nearby. Testified to nothing. He said, I didn't hear anything. I didn't see anything. Okay, and then Nyox was questioned at the end of the 50s by Hans Werner Woltersdorf, author of several books. He met him. And when he visited him in 1959, okay, so he and apparently three other people had lunch together. And he says it soon became apparent that he was the Alfred Nyox who had been involved in the Radio Gleiwitz affair. So they got around to that issue. I told him that at the Nuremberg trials and numerous other trials of war criminals, thousands of people had been executed or given life sentences for lesser crimes. He, on the other hand, attested to having selected a number of concentration camp inmates, dressed them in Polish uniforms, knowing that not one of them would escape alive, and basically planned a murder with malice, and nothing happened to him. How can that be explained? Woltersdorf asks. And Nyox says, you can see for yourself that I'm still alive and that I'm doing very well, and that is for me what counts.
He kind of admitted that's what for him, what counts. He probably took a nice piece of change from the Allies, and they probably set him up in business. I mean, a lot of people were really struggling, and yet he becomes a very successful businessman. So who set him up?
Yep. And it is well understood by the victors, Wendig writes, it is well understood why the victors were interested in a confession such as this in the fall of 45, before the Hossbach document was discovered. And he says he suspects that's a forgery. The Allies needed a testimony as this to show that Hitler allegedly, already on August 10th, weeks before the war started and ahead of the signing of the German-Soviet Pact of August 23rd, 1939, wanted war. And that he needed the Polish provocation as a casus belli, as a reason for war. That all along Hitler was a liar. He just wanted to have peace as part of his little game he was playing with the world. That's why they needed it.
Right.
And they ended up running with the Hossbach protocol after that came to be known, as it were. So, and incidentally, Otto Radek, this this guard who was issued live rounds, etc., this battalion 1/68 at Gleiwitz, he's left out of the after the battle account completely. There's not one mention of him.
Really?
That is a huge omission.
It sure is.
Exist for that author, Mr. Whitehead. So there you have it. And in the 42, Naujoks was dismissed from the SS and transferred to the Wehrmacht as punishment. He was thereafter stricken from the SS lists. So this man isn't one with much integrity.
No.
So. And I guess that's about it. I mean, again, if people want the details of after the battle, this could be another three or four shows. One need only get it. And, you know, like I said, when I finally get around to publishing my account of Kristallnacht, Gleiwitz, Reichstag fire, etc., all the false flags, I'll have it all in there.
Oh, that would be absolutely wonderful to have all of that in one place where people can just get all the details. That would be super.
And there is so much. Wilf is working on the other part of this VFZ article, which is yet another version. The Viertel Jahrhefte für Zeitgeschichte is the name of that little archive. So that's going to be the other one, and that's by Jürgen Runzheimer. He's the one that wrote up this little silly account. So, and people can get, you know, the Fedor von Bock war diary, the Halder war diary. All these war diaries are important because a lot of times the generals will drop little details on certain dates, and they tend to date things, which is what we need. I find it very strange that those editors left that August 20th out of Halder's diary. That is so frustrating. So if anyone has the German version on the 20th, it would be nice to have a...
Yes, it would.
...translation of what happened on that day. Does he mention anything about Himmler at all?
Right.
And I guess that's about it.
All righty. Well, this has been very fascinating. One thing. I received an email today, and it's from a gentleman who said he understands that the people at Nuremberg were tortured to get confessions. But then when they were on trial and they gave their testimonies, they were not being tortured. Why couldn't they have just recanted? Why didn't they? Especially Hoss. He comes right out and admits everything. I'm thinking...
You can't pin down human psychology. That's a great question. Why didn't they just say it's all lies? I was forced to do it in front of the world. But everybody has a different breaking point in personal protocol. And not everyone is able to do that. It could even be, we don't know because we weren't there and we don't know what was said by the Allies, that they said, if you confess, we won't actually hang you. You'll live. So just say what we told you to say. We're presenting your information. Get up there and attest to it. We'll let you live. I mean, we don't know that they weren't lied to. We do not know what was said. We don't know what kind of threats were made behind closed doors. None of that's documented.
Of course. And we don't know what they said that they would do to these people's families.
That's another thing. There were family threats. Absolutely. That is confirmed by Freda Utley in The High Cost of Vengeance. She said that when she interviewed several of these victims, they told her that they made family threats. They worried about their families. They worried about kids. Treatment of Germans generally was also an issue. Retaliation kind of stuff. That is a huge motivating factor. Huge.
Right.
And that's one very good reason why they would continue to tell lies on the witness stand. There's a lot of factors involved in that. I would very much encourage people to go to PBS. I believe it's pbs.org and look up the confessions. Those four Navy men that were interrogated by an aggressive police chief all admitted to raping this Blasco woman. And this happened recently in the United States, the democracy, freedom, etc. Not one of them was guilty. And in fact, the DNA came back negative, the test on at least one of these men, and he still admitted and kept confirming in detail his rape of Blasco. Turned out she was raped by a totally different man, completely unrelated to any of these four, who were all implicated by one, the first guy, implicated the second guy, implicated the third guy, the fourth guy. So they all implicated one another, and the real perpetrator, they weren't even looking at him. In fact, they were trying to get him off and unrelated. It's just PBS.org, The Confessions. Look up those Navy men and you will see. It is stunning. Friedrich Berg is the one that pointed that out to me. He says, this is exactly what happened at Nuremberg on a bigger scale. Exactly. You will see the process of how they do it. And these guys were describing the rape in detail. In detail.
My goodness.
Didn't happen. It's incredible.
It is.
So that's a good one into the psychology of confessions.
Right. And depending on the severity of the torture, had they gone into the courtroom in front of the allies, in front of the stacked judges.
Right.
And recanted, what would happen to them as soon as they left the stand? I'm certain that they remembered how brutal the torture was.
Right, right. In the world, let's face it, the world doesn't care.
Indeed.
There are select few who do, but generally the world doesn't care about what's going on behind closed doors. They're not concerned about Mr. Hearst after his testimony.
Right.
What did they care? So a Nazi war criminal was brutalized after he tried to clear his name. So he deserved it.
Yeah, he was German, right? He was a Nazi, right?
Right. That's the kind of attitude that was prevailing at the time. And it's still the general attitude. Who today cares about these quote-unquote jihadists who are being murdered left and right? I mean, most Americans will say, well, they're guilty just because they're, you know, Islamic extremists. So what?
Right.
So what? We got to fight this. They're going to come here if we don't torture and kill them there. That, and it still prevails to this day.
Right.
So that's the kind of thing we're dealing with. And we can look at the case of Saddam. He did defend himself, and quite well, if I might say so myself. He was still murdered.
Yes.
So what good did it do?
Right.
And does anyone believe Saddam Hussein? He testified on his own behalf, said, you people called us to count. And we still call him a brutal dictator. You know, I don't know that he had gold-plated toilets and that his sons were driving down the freeway shooting people for fun. This all sounds like idiocy to me.
Sure.
And then they find all these great testimonials from these people who clearly were enemies of the regime for whatever reason. We have no idea why. He, you know, had rape rooms. He beat us on the bottom of our feet. We have video footage. We have no idea what video footage we were shown on the television in glimpses.
Right.
You know, glimpses. That could be from CIA torture, for goodness sake. We have no idea what we're even looking at.
Probably is.
And yeah, and we have torture prisons in Poland confirmed.
Right.
So, you know, tell me about it. We got a little miniature Holocaust going on in Afghanistan in one of our sponsored hospitals. We have an article about that on the site. They described it as quote-unquote Auschwitz conditions in modern Afghanistan. Now, we know that the Allies induced those conditions the first time, and now they're doing it again. This is nothing new.
Right.
So, yeah, I would definitely encourage The Confessions, though. People have got to watch that. It's a long documentary, but it is so worth it because you see exactly how they implicate one another when they are 100% innocent.
Wow.
And they even go further along in the process of cooperation in their own downfall. It's bizarre. But again, human psychology, you know, these people understand us better than we do. It's almost valuable to study psychology so that you know how to counteract their onslaught against you.
Right, because they put you in that frame of mind.
Oh, yeah.
Through the torture, and it isn't just a physical torture, it's mental, so that
right.
you become absolutely submissive to your captors.
Exactly, and these guys weren't tortured. They were simply interrogated for long periods of time. They still got it. We all raped Miss Blasco.
Yes.
And they didn't.
Wow.
So, it's incredible.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for all of this information, your scholarship. It's just wonderful.
You are so welcome.
And
thank you for having me.
All righty. And we'll talk to you next week.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.